unscrewed the top with his right, and then also held the glass with his right hand. That was when I realized. Afterwards, I went to talk to him. Not a successful conversation. I could tell he just wanted to be rid of me. And then at the bar, he was holding his wine glass with his right hand. It actually gave me the shivers.
Could it be something neurological?
That's more or less what he said himself.
What? You confronted him about it?
Not me, but afterwards I refused to believe my own eyes. I watched all the TV clips of Leo I could find online. I even called and spoke to my old colleagues, but none of them had noticed a thing. Nobody ever seems to notice anything. Then I spoke to Nina West. She's a forex trader and pretty sharp, and she'd noticed the change. You can imagine how relieved I was to hear that. She's the one who asked him about it.
And what did he say?
He was embarrassed and started muttering. He said he was ambidextrous, that he decided to change hands after his mother died as a part of his liberation, that he was looking for a new way of living.
Isn't that a good enough explanation?
Both hyperacoustic and ambidextrous. That seems a bit much to me.
Blomqvist looked out at Zinkenstein.
Maybe. But it's not impossible.
But he reflected for a while longer.
You're right in saying something doesn't feel right about this story. Let's get together again soon.
Absolutely, she said.
They ended the call and he continued in the direction of Skanstuhl and Hilde van Kantaborg. Over the years, Bublansky had taken quite a liking to Salander, but he still did not feel at ease in her presence. He knew that she disliked authority, and even though he could sympathize given her background, he hated generalizations.
Eventually you'll have to start trusting people, Lisbeth. Even the police. Otherwise you'll have a hard time of it, he said.
I'll do my best, she said dryly.
He was sitting facing her, fidgeting in the visitors' section in H Block. She looked oddly young, he thought.
Let me begin by expressing my deepest sympathies at the death of Holger Palmgren. It must have been a big blow. I remember when I lost my wife.
Skip it, she said.
Okay, let's get to the point. Do you have any idea why anyone would want to kill Palmgren?
Salander raised her hand to her shoulder just above her chest, where she had an old bullet wound. She started to speak with a strange coldness, which made Bublansky feel quite uncomfortable, but what she said did at least have the advantage of being concise and accurate. An interrogator's dream, in a way.
A few weeks ago, Holger had a visit from an elderly woman named Maj-Britt Torell, a former secretary to Professor Johannes Kaldin, who was once head of St. Stephen's Psychiatric Clinic for Children in Uppsala.
Where you were a patient?
She had read about me in the newspapers and left him a bunch of documents. At first, Holger didn't think they contained anything new, but in the end, they turned out to have serious implications. There had been plans to have me adopted when I was little, and I always thought it was a misguided attempt to help deal with the problems linked to my bastard of a father. But these documents prove it was actually part of a scientific experiment set up by an authority called the Registry for the Study of Genetics and Social Environment. Its existence is a secret, and I was annoyed that I couldn't find the names of the people in charge of it, so I called Holger and asked him to take a closer look at those documents. I have no idea what he found. All I know is that Mikael Blomqvist called to tell me that Holger was dead, that he might have been murdered. So my advice is that you contact Maj-Britt Torell. She lives in Aspuden. She may have copies of the documents, or they may be backed up somewhere. It might also be a good idea to check that she's okay from time to time.
Thanks, he said. That is helpful. What exactly did this authority do?
The name ought to give you a clue.
Names can be misleading.
There's a creep called Teleborian.
We've questioned him already.
Do it again.
What should we be looking for?
You could try grilling the heads of the genetics centre at Uppsala, but I doubt you'll get very far.
Could you be a bit more specific, Lisbeth?
What's all this about? About science, or rather pseudoscience, and about some idiots who imagined you could study the impact of social environment and heredity by sending children away for adoption.
Doesn't sound too good.
Full marks for insight, she said.
Any other clues?
No.
Bublansky did not believe her.
I'm sure you know that Holger's last words were, "Talk to Hilda von." Does that ring any bells?
It certainly did. It had rung a bell when Blomqvist called the day before, too. But for the time being, she kept that to herself. She had her reasons. Neither did she mention anything about Leo Mannheimer or the woman with the birthmark. She gave only brusque answers to the rest of Oblansky's questions. Then she said goodbye and was taken back to her cell. At 9 a.m. the following morning she would be leaving Floridberg. She supposed that Fager was eager to be rid of her.
Chapter 12. June 20th. Raquel Greitz was, as usual, unhappy about the job the cleaners had done. She should have given firmer instructions. Now she had to do the mopping and drying herself, and water her houseplants, and tidy up the books, the glasses, the cups. No matter that she was feeling sick and that her hair was coming out in tufts. She gritted her teeth. She had a lot to do. She read one more time through the documents she had taken from Holger Palmgren. It was not hard to see which were the references that had prompted his telephone call. The notes in themselves were not so much of a problem, especially since Teleborian had been good enough to refer to her using only her initial. There was no detailed description of the actual research being done, and no other children had been named. In any case, that is not what made her uncomfortable. What upset her was the fact that Palmgren had been reading them now, after all these years. It could have been a coincidence. Martin Steinberg believed so. Maybe Palmgren had had the papers for ages and decided on a whim to look through them, which then got him thinking about the information without attaching too much importance to it. If that is how it was, then her recent actions would have been a disastrous mistake. But Greitz did not believe in coincidence, not now that so much was teetering on the brink of disaster. Plus, she knew that Palmgren had recently been to see Salander at Floridberg Women's Prison. Greitz was not going to underestimate Salander again, especially not with Hilda von Canterbourg's name in the documents. Hilda was the only connection Greitz could think of that might lead Salander to her. She was pretty certain that Hilda had not been indiscreet again, not since her unfortunate friendship with Agneta Salander, but you could never be sure about anything, and it was possible that there were copies of the documents out there, which was why it was crucial for Greitz to find out how Palmgren had gotten hold of them. Had it been in the context of the Teleborian investigation, or had he gotten them later? And if so, from whom? Greitz had been convinced they had removed all the sensitive material from St. Stephen's, but maybe... She was deep in thought when an idea struck her. Johannes Kaldin, the head of the clinic. He had always been a thorn in their side. Could he have handed over the papers before he died? Or had someone close to him done so, such as his... Greitz swore to herself. Of course, that bloody woman! She went into the kitchen and swallowed 2 painkillers with a glass of lemonade. Then she called Steinberg. That wimp could get off his backside and make himself useful, and told him to get in touch with my Brit Tourette, as Greitz liked to call her. Right away, she said. Now! Then she made herself an arugula salad with walnuts and tomatoes and cleaned the bathroom. It was 5:30 p.m. She felt warm, even though the balcony door was open. She longed to be able to take off her turtleneck and put on a linen shirt, but resisted the temptation and again thought of Hilda. She had nothing but contempt for the woman. Hilda was a lush and a slut, yet there had been a time when Greitz envied her. Men flocked around her, women and children too, for that matter. She had an open and generous mind in the good old days, when they all had such high hopes. Their project was not the only one of its kind. Their source of inspiration had been in New York, though she and Steinberg had driven their project further. Even though they had sometimes been surprised or disappointed by their findings, she had never thought the broader costs, taken as a whole, were too high. Admittedly, some of the children were worse off than others, but that was the lottery of life. Project 9 was fundamentally worthy and important. That was how she saw it. It would show the world how to produce stronger and better balanced individuals, and that is why it was such a tragedy that 2 of their subjects had jeopardized everything and forced her to take such extreme measures. She was not particularly troubled by her transgressions, and sometimes that surprised her. She did not, after all, lack self-knowledge, and she knew that she was not much inclined to remorse. But she did worry about consequences. Distant shouting and laughter could be heard out on Karlbergswegen. Her apartment smelled of detergent and rubbing alcohol. She looked at her watch again, got up from her desk, and took out another doctor's bag. This one was black and more modern, and a new discreet wig, new sunglasses, a few syringes and ampoules, and a small bottle containing bright blue liquid. Then she retrieved a walking stick with a silver handle from the closet and a grey hat from the shelf in the hall, and she went down to wait for Benjamin to pick her up and take her to Skarnstuhl. Hilda von Kantaborg poured herself a glass of white wine and drank it slowly. She was, without question, an alcoholic. Even if she did not drink as much as was widely believed, she did drink too much, just as she overindulged in her other vices. Contrary to what people thought, Hilda was not some grand noblewoman fallen on hard times, nor was she someone who just drifted around and got drunk. She was still publishing articles on psychology, under the pseudonym Leonard Bart. Her father, Wilmer Carlson, had been a contractor and a con man until he was convicted of gross fraud by Sundsvall District Court. Later he came across the name of one Johann Friedrich Kantaberg, a young lieutenant in the Royal Life Guard Dragoons who died in a duel in 1787, the last of his line. Thanks to some negotiating and one or two tricks, and despite the strict rules of the Swedish House of Nobility, Wilmer Carlson managed to change his name, not to Kantaberg, but to Kantaborg, and on his own initiative he added a von, which in due course found its way into official records. Hilda found the name clumsy and affected, particularly after her father abandoned the family and moved into a dismal two-room apartment in central Timrå. The name von Kantaborg sounded as out of place in those surroundings as she herself would have felt at the House of Nobility. Maybe a part of her personality was shaped in defiance of the name. During her teenage years, she experimented with drugs and hung out with greasers in the town centre. But she did well at school and went on to study psychology at Stockholm University. She spent much of her early years there partying, but the teachers began to take notice of her. She was attractive and intelligent and an original thinker. She also had high moral standards, though not in the way that was expected of girls in those days. She was no prude, nor some quiet, pretty little thing. She abhorred injustice, and she never let anyone down. Just after she had defended her thesis, she happened to see sociology professor Martin Steinberg in a restaurant on Rörstrandsgatan in Vasastan. All doctoral students knew Steinberg. He was tall and handsome, with a well-groomed moustache, and he looked a bit like David Niven. He was married to a stocky woman called Gertrude, who was occasionally taken for his mother. She was 14 years older and quite plain beside her charismatic husband. It was said that Steinberg saw other women, that he was a real power player with more clout than even his impressive CV would seem to warrant. He had been head of the Department of Social Work at Stockholm University and had chaired a number of government inquiries. Hilda found him dogmatic and obtuse, but she was fascinated by him, and not just by his appearance and his aura. She saw him as a riddle to be solved. She was intrigued when she saw him in that restaurant with a woman who was certainly not his wife. She had short, ash-blonde hair, beautiful, determined eyes, and a regal presence. Hilda could not be sure that this was a lover's tryst, but Steinberg was obviously disturbed when he caught sight of her. There was, in fact, nothing out of the ordinary about the scene. Even so, it felt as if she had caught a glimpse of the secret life she had always imagined Steinberg to be living, and she quickly stole out again. During the days and weeks that followed, Steinberg looked at her with curiosity, and one evening he invited her to take a walk with him along the forest paths around the university. The sky was dark that day. For a long time Steinberg stayed quiet, though it seemed he was on the verge of sharing something important with her. Then he broke the silence with a question that was so trite that it amazed her. "Have you ever wondered, Hilda, why you are just as you are?" She answered politely. "Yes, Martin, I have. It's one of the big questions, not just for our own pasts, but also for our future," he said. That was how she was drawn into Project 9. For a long time it seemed harmless. A number of children from different social backgrounds who had been placed in foster homes when they were small were tested and assessed. Some were gifted, others not. But none of the results were made public. On the surface, there was nothing at all exploitative about it, quite the opposite.
The children were treated with care and consideration, and in some areas the team was initiating new, if not pioneering, lines of research. Yet, with the benefit of hindsight, she should have asked more questions. How had the children been selected, and why had so many been placed in such widely different social circumstances? Gradually she came to understand the broader picture, but by then the door was closed. And in any case, she still thought the project was defensible, both as a whole and for each individual case. Then came another autumn, and the news that Carl Sager had been accidentally killed during an elk hunt. That really frightened her. She decided to get out. Steinberg and Greitz noticed it right away. They gave her the chance to have a positive influence on the project, and that kept her involved for a little while longer. Her task was to save one particular girl who was living an absolute nightmare with her twin sister on Lundegatan in Stockholm. The authorities had been no help, so Hilda was to find a solution and a foster family. Nothing was as straightforward as she had been told. She found herself getting close to the mother and the girl. She stood up for them, and it cost her her career. It almost cost her her life. Sometimes she regretted it, but more often she was proud, and she came to see it as the best thing she had done during her time at the registry. Now, as the evening drew in, Hilda drank her Chardonnay and looked out the window. People were strolling by and looking happy. Did she feel like going down and settling with a book at some outdoor café? No sooner had the thought occurred to her than she spotted a figure getting out of a black Renault a little way down the street. It was Rachel Greitz. There was nothing strange about that in itself. Greitz came by every now and again and treated her to a flood of friendly chatter and flattery. But lately things had not felt quite right. Greitz had sounded tense on the phone and had begun to utter threats again, just as she used to. She was now standing on the pavement outside, wearing a disguise, but nevertheless unmistakable. And she was accompanied by Benjamin. Benjamin Forsch was Greitz's factotum. He not only ran her errands, but he was also called in when there was need for coercion. Or brute force. Hilda was frightened by what she saw, and made an instant and drastic decision. She quickly put on her coat and grabbed her wallet and mobile, which had been lying on silent on her desk. Then she left the apartment and locked the door. Not quite quick enough. Footsteps could be heard in the entrance hall below. She was gripped by panic and rushed downstairs, knowing that she might run straight into their grasp. As luck would have it, they were waiting for the lift. Hilda made it into the backyard, her only escape route that avoided the street entrance. She could climb over a yellow wall at the far end if she moved the garden table a little closer. The table screeched as she pushed it across the flagstones. She scrambled over the wall like a clumsy child and dropped into the neighbouring yard, and then made her way out onto Bohusgarten. There she turned towards Eriksdalsbadet and the waterfront. She walked quickly, even though her left foot throbbed from the fall, and she was not entirely sober. Down near the outdoor gym by Orstaviken, she reached for her mobile. There were a number of missed calls, and when she listened to the messages she realized that something was very wrong. The journalist Mikael Blomqvist had been trying to reach her, and even though he apologized profusely, his voice sounded agitated. In his second message he added that now that Holger Palmgren was dead, he was particularly keen to have a word. "Holger Palmgren," she muttered to herself. "Holger Palmgren. Why did that name sound familiar?" She searched on her mobile, and it came up immediately. Palmgren had been Lisbeth Salander's guardian. Of course. Some story was obviously about to break, and that was not good. If the media were chasing after information, she could be the weak link. As she walked faster, she looked out towards the water and the trees, and all the people strolling or picnicking on the grass. Just beyond the outdoor gym, by the open space on the waterfront, where the small boats were moored, she saw three surly-looking teenage boys sprawled on a blanket, drinking beer. She stopped and looked at her mobile again. Hilda was no expert in technology, but she did know that it could be used to track her. So she made a quick last call to her sister, which she immediately regretted. Every one of their telephone conversations left an aftertaste of guilt and accusation. Then she walked over to the teenagers and chose one with long, straggly hair and a frayed denim jacket. She held out her telephone. "Here you go," she said. "An iPhone. Brand new. It's yours. Just change the SIM card or whatever."
"What?
Why are you giving me this?" "Because you seem like such a nice guy. Good luck. Don't buy any drugs," she said.
and then she hurried away in the evening sun. 30 minutes later she was standing at an ATM in Hornstull, damp from the heat, and withdrew 3,000 kroner in cash before heading for Stockholm Central Station. She would go to Nyköping, to a small, out-of-the-way hotel where she had gone into hiding years ago, when all her colleagues at the university had accused her of being a slut. Blomqvist passed an older woman in the doorway. She was wearing a hat and carrying a walking stick, and she was followed by a powerfully built man of his own age, who must have been 6.5 feet tall, with small eyes and a round face. But he didn't pay them much attention. He was just relieved to have managed to get into the building, and he ran up the stairs to Hilda von Kantaborg's apartment. There did not seem to be anyone at home. He left and walked towards the Clarion Hotel in Skarnstuhl, and there he tried to call her again. This time an arrogant voice answered. A son, perhaps.
"Hey?" "Hello," Blomqvist said. "Is Hilda there?"
"There's no fucking Hildas here.
This is my mobile now." "What do you mean?"
"Some crazy drunk woman gave it to me."
"When?"
"Just now."
"How did she seem?"
"Stressed and bonkers."
"Where are you?"
"None of your fucking business,"
the boy said, and hung up. Blomqvist swore. For want of anything better to do, he went into the bar of the Clarion and ordered a Guinness. He sat down in an armchair next to the windows overlooking Ringvägen. He needed to think. A bored man at the reception desk behind him was in a heated argument over his bill. Two young women were sitting not far from his window table and whispering. Thoughts were chasing around in his head. Salander had mentioned lists of names, and Leo Mannheimer. In view of Palmgren's death and the documents found in his hallway, it was probably safe to assume that whatever this was all about had happened a long time ago. Talk to Hilda von. Could he have meant somebody other than Hilda von Kantaborg? It was possible, but unlikely. Plus there had been Hilda's erratic behaviour just now, giving her mobile away to a teenage boy. Blomqvist's Guinness arrived. He looked over at the young women sitting in the bar, who now seemed to be whispering about him. He took out his mobile and searched for Hilda von Kantaborg. He did not expect to find what he was looking for so swiftly on Google, or for anything to be available online, but he might be able to read between the lines. Leads could sometimes be found in perfectly anodyne or evasive answers to interview questions, or in someone's choice of subjects or interests. He found nothing. Hilda had been a reasonably prolific author of scientific articles until she lost her position at Stockholm University. Then there was silence. Blomqvist found no trail of clues to follow, and in the old material, nothing remotely confidential or shady, or to do with adopted children, and still less boys with hyperacusis who had gone from being left-handed to being right-handed. Her articles did muster clear and sound arguments against the hidden racist agenda, which at the time was still in evidence in research into the significance of nature over nurture, but that was it. He ordered another Guinness. Maybe there was someone he could call. He searched the articles for names of co-authors and colleagues, and then he looked up von Kantaborg in the directory. He found only one other living person in the country with that name, a woman 6 years younger, by the name of Charlotte. She lived a few blocks away on Rensdiernasgata, and was listed as a hairdresser with a salon on Jutgarten. Blomqvist looked at photographs of Hilda and Charlotte von Kantaborg, and saw the resemblance. But they were probably sisters. Without giving it much thought, he dialed Charlotte's number.
"Lotta?" said the voice.
"Hello. My name is Mikael Blomqvist, and I'm a journalist at Millennium Magazine," he said. And he sensed at once that this worried her. He was used to that, and he often regretted it, and joked that he should write more positive articles so that people would not get anxious when he called, but this time there seemed to be more to it. "I'm so sorry to disturb you. I need to get hold of Hilda von Kantaborg," he said.
"What happened to her?"
Not has anything happened to her, but what happened.
"When did you last hear from her?" he asked.
"Only an hour ago."
"And where was she at the time?"
"Can I ask why you're calling? I mean, well, it's not as though journalists come looking for her all the time these days."
She drew a deep breath.
"I don't mean to worry you," Blomqvist said.
"She sounded frightened. What's going on?"
"I honestly don't know," he said. "But a wonderful old man called Holger Palmgren has been murdered. I was there while he was fighting for his life, and the last thing he said was that I should talk to Hilda.
I think she has some important information.
About what?
That's what I'm trying to find out. I want to help her. I want us to help each other.
How can I know whether to believe that?
Blomqvist answered with surprising honesty. In my job, it's not that easy to promise anything. The truth, if I manage to find it, that is, can end up hurting even those to whom I wish no harm. But most of us tend to feel better once we've opened up about what's troubling us.
She feels absolutely horrible,
Lotta said. I understand.
She's been feeling horrible for the last 20 years, in fact. But this time it seems worse than ever.
Why is that, do you think?
I have no idea.
He heard the hesitation in her voice and struck like a cobra. Can I pop round for a moment? I see you live nearby. That seemed to make the woman even more nervous, but he was almost certain she would say yes. So it surprised him when she answered with a sharp and uncompromising,
No, I don't want to get involved.
Involved in what?
Well...
Blomqvist could hear her breathing hard on the other end of the line. He understood that this was one of those moments when things hang in the balance. He had experienced it many times as a journalist. When people get to the point of debating whether to speak out or not, they tend to freeze in concentration as they try to weigh the consequences. He knew that this often ended with them talking. But there were no guarantees, so he tried not to sound too eager. Is there something you want to say?
When Hilda writes, she sometimes uses the pseudonym Leonard Bach,
Lotta said.
Oh, wow. Is that her?
So you've heard of Leonard Bach?
Oh, maybe just an old hack, but I do try to keep reasonably up to date with the culture pages. I like his, or rather her, stuff. But why is this important?
As Leonard Bach, she wrote a feature article for Svenska Dagbladet, under the title Born Together, Raised Apart. This would have been about 3 years ago.
Okay.
It was about a scientific investigation by some people at the University of Minnesota. Nothing out of the ordinary, but it was important to her. That was obvious from the way she talked about it.
Right, he said. What are you trying to say?
Nothing, really. Except that she was clearly upset by it.
Can you be a little more specific?
I don't actually know anything more. I've never been bothered to dig into it, and Hilda never said a word about it, however much I pressed her. But you can draw the same conclusions from the article as I did.
Thanks. I'll follow it up.
Promise not to write anything too nasty about her.
I think there are bigger crooks than Hilda in this story, he said.
They said goodbye, and Blomqvist paid for his drinks before leaving the hotel. He crossed over to Jutgården, and then continued up towards Medborgarsplatsen and St. Paulsgatan. He waved aside both acquaintances and strangers who wanted to talk to him. The last thing he felt like was socializing. He only wanted to read the article, but he waited until he was home before looking it up on his computer. He went through it 3 times, and afterwards read a number of other essays on the same topic and made a couple of calls. He kept going until 12:30 a.m. He then poured himself a glass of Barolo and speculated that he might be beginning to understand a little of what had happened, even if he had not yet worked out what part Salander had played in the story. He had to speak to her, he thought, whatever the prison management might say.
Part 2. Troubling Tones. June 21st. A minor sixth chord consists of a keynote, a third, a fifth, and a sixth from the melodic minor scale. In American jazz and pop music, the minor seventh is the most common minor chord. It is considered elegant and beautiful. The minor sixth is rarely used. The tone may be regarded as harsh and ominous. Chapter 13. June 21st. Salander had left the maximum security unit for the last time. She was now standing in the guard box of Lourdesbury prison, being scrutinized from head to toe by a crew-cut young man with angry red skin and small, arrogant eyes. "A Mikael Blomqvist called, looking for you," he said. Salander ignored this information. She did not even look up. It was 9:30 in the morning, and she just wanted to get out of there. She was irritated by the paperwork she still had to deal with and scribbled illegibly on the forms required to take receipt of her laptop and her mobile. Olsen had not needed much persuading to see to it that they were both fully charged.
After that, they let her go. She passed through the gates, walked the length of the wall and along the railway line, and sat by the main road on a bench with peeling red paint to wait for bus number 113 to Örebro. It was a hot morning, and the air was still. Flies were buzzing around her. Even though she turned her face to the sun and seemed to be enjoying the weather, she did not feel any particular joy at being out of prison. But she was happy to have her laptop back. Sitting on the bench, her black jeans sticking to her legs, she opened it up and logged on. She checked that Giannini had sent her, as promised, the file on the police investigation into the death of Jamal Chowdhury. There it was in her inbox. Salander would be able to deal with it on the journey home. Giannini had a theory, a suspicion based partly on the strange fact that Faria had refused to say a word during police questioning, and partly on a short CCTV sequence from the Tunnelbana station at Hornstuhl. Giannini appeared to have discussed it with an imam in Bodkirke called Hassan Ferdusi, and he believed she might be on the right track. The thought now was that Salander, with her skills, should take a look as well. So she set about locating it in the file Giannini had sent her. Before examining the sequence, she looked out at the road and the yellowing fields and thought of Holger Palmgren. She had spent most of the night thinking about him. Talk to Hilda von... Hilda von Canterbourg was the only Hilda von known to Salander. Dear old Hilda, with her sweeping gestures, who had often sat in their kitchen at home on Lundergarten when Salander was a child, and who was one of her mother's few friends when everything around her was falling apart. Hilda had been a rock, at least so Salander had believed. That was the reason Salander had looked her up one day, some 10 years ago now. They spent a whole evening together, drinking cheap rosé, because Salander had wanted to find out more about her mother. Hilda told her quite a lot, and Salander told her one or two things as well. She shared confidences with Hilda which she had kept even from Palmgren. It had been a long evening, and they had raised their glasses to Agneta, and to all women whose lives had been destroyed by shits and bastards. But Hilda had not breathed a word about the registry. Had she kept the most important thing to herself? Salander refused to believe it at first. She was usually good at detecting what might be hidden beneath the surface, but she might have been fooled by Hilda's whole damaged facade. She thought back to the files she had downloaded on Olsen's computer, and remembered a pair of initials in those documents. H.K. Was it conceivable that they referred to Hilda von Canterbourg? Salander ran a search and discovered that Hilda had been a more influential psychologist than she had realized at the time. A flash of anger flared in her, but she decided to withhold judgment for the time being. The number 113 to Örebro was approaching in a cloud of dust and spewing gravel. She paid the driver and sat down at the back, where she had a careful look at the CCTV sequence showing the ticket barrier at Hornstuhl station just after midnight on October 24th, nearly 2 years ago. Gradually she focused in on one detail, an irregularity in the movement of the suspect's hand. Could it be relevant? She was not sure. She knew that movement recognition as a technology was still in its infancy. She had no doubt that all human gestures carry a mathematical fingerprint. It is still difficult to read, however. Every little movement is made up of thousands of pieces of information, and is in itself not wholly conclusive. Every time we scratch our heads, there is a difference. Our gestures are always similar, but never exactly the same. One needs sensors, signal processors, gyroscopes, accelerometers, motion-plotting algorithms, Fourier analyses, and frequency and distance gauges to be able to describe and compare movements with precision. There were some programs available for download from the Internet, but that was not an option. It would take too long. She had another idea. She thought of her friends in Hacker Republic and the deep neural network which Plague and Trinity had been working on for so long. Could that be optimized and used? It was not out of the question. It would require her to find a more comprehensive index of hand movements for the algorithms to study and learn from, but it would not be impossible. She worked hard on the train from Örebro back to Stockholm, and in the end had a wild thought. The prison service would not think much of it, especially not on her first day of freedom, but that was irrelevant. She got off the train at Central Station and took a taxi home to Fiskargatan, where she continued to work. Dan Brody laid his guitar a newly purchased Ramirez, on the coffee table and went into the kitchen to make himself a double espresso, which he drank so quickly it burned his tongue. It was 9:10 a.m. He had not noticed the time go by. He had lost himself in Recuerdos de la Alhambra, and was now late for work. Not that it mattered much to anyone, but he did not want to give the impression that he did not take his work seriously, so he went into his bedroom and picked out a white shirt, dark suit, and black church's shoes. Then he hurried down to the street to discover that it was already oppressively hot. Summer, to his dismay, was in full swing. His suit felt wrong for the time of year, severe and inappropriate in the sunshine, and after only a few feet his back and armpits were damp with sweat. It only added to his sense of alienation. He looked at the gardeners working in Humlegården. The noise of the lawn mowers pained him. He continued at high speed towards Stureplan, and even though he still felt uncomfortable, he noted with some satisfaction that other suited men also had sweaty, miserable faces. The heat had come suddenly after a long period of rain. There was an ambulance standing further down on Birger Jarlsgatan, and he thought about his mother. She had died in childbirth. His father was a travelling musician who never paid any attention to him and had died young, from cirrhosis of the liver, after many years of heavy drinking. Dan, who was born Daniel Brolin, grew up in an orphanage in Gävle, and later, from the age of 6, as one of 4 foster children on a farm to the north of Hudiksvall. He had to work extremely hard there with the animals and the harvest, mucking out the stables and slaughtering and butchering the pigs. The farmer, his foster father, Sten, made no secret of the fact that he had taken on his foster children, all of them boys, because he needed extra hands. When the boys came to live with him, Sten was married to a red-haired, thick-set woman called Christina. But she had pretty soon taken off and had not been heard of since. She was said to have gone to Norway, and people who met Sten were hardly surprised that she had tired of him. He was tall and imposing, and by no means ugly, with a carefully groomed beard which was beginning to turn grey, but there was something grim about his mouth and forehead which frightened people. He seldom smiled. He did not like socialising or small talk, and he hated pretension and refinement. He was always saying, "Don't get ideas above your station. Don't think you're anything special." When the boys in their high spirits declared that they wanted to become professional footballers when they grew up, or lawyers, or millionaires, he would always snap back, "One should know one's place." He was stingy when it came to praise and encouragement, and certainly when it came to money. He distilled his own spirits, ate the meat of animals which he himself had shot or slaughtered, and the farm was as good as self-sufficient. Nothing was ever bought unless heavily discounted or in a clearance sale. He got his furniture at the flea market, or it was passed on by neighbours and relatives. His house was painted a strident yellow, and nobody knew why until it transpired that Sten had gotten the paint free from surplus stock. Sten had no appreciation of beauty, and he never read books or newspapers. But that did not trouble Daniel, since there was a library at the school. But he was bothered by the fact that Sten disliked all music unless it was jolly and Swedish. All Daniel had inherited from his biological father was his surname and a nylon-stringed Levin guitar, which had been abandoned in the attic of the farmhouse until Daniel picked it up one day and which he came to love. It was not only that the instrument seemed to have been waiting for him, he felt that he was born to play it. He soon learned the basic chords and harmonies and realized that he could copy tunes from the radio, having heard them only once. For a long time he played the usual repertoire of a boy of his generation, ZZ Top's Tush, the Scorpions' ballad Still Loving You, Dire Straits' Money for Nothing, and several other rock classics. But then something happened. One cold autumn day he stole out of the cowshed. He was 14 years old, and school was a nightmare. He was quick to learn, but found it difficult to listen to the teachers. He was disturbed by the racket around him and yearned to get back to the silence and calm of the farm, even though he hated the work and the long days. He escaped whenever he could to find time for himself. On this particular day, just after 5:30 p.m., he came into the kitchen and turned on the radio, which was playing something corny and dull. He fiddled with the dial and turned to P2. He knew very little about the station. He had thought it was mostly oldies, and what he heard only confirmed his prejudice. It was a clarinet solo, and the sound jarred on his nerves, like the buzzing of a bee or an alarm going off. But he kept listening,
and then the sound of a guitar came in, a tentative, playful guitar. He shivered. There was a new feeling in the room, a sense of reverence and concentration, and he felt himself come alive. He heard nothing else, not the other boys swearing and arguing, or the birds or tractors or distant cars, or even the sound of approaching footsteps. He just stood there, cocooned in an unexpected joy, and tried to understand what made these notes different from everything he had ever heard before. Why did they affect him so much? Then suddenly he felt a sharp pain in his scalp and neck.
"You lazy little shit! You think I don't see how you're always sneaking off?"
Sten was pulling Daniel's hair, shouting and swearing, but Daniel barely noticed. He was focusing only on one thing, listening to the end of the tune. The music seemed to be showing him something unknown, something richer and greater than the life he had so far been living. Although he did not manage to hear who had been playing, he glanced up at the old kitchen clock above the tiled stove as Sten dragged him out of the room. He knew that the exact time was important. The next day he used one of the school telephones to ring Radio Sweden. He had never done anything like it before. He did not possess that kind of resourcefulness and self-confidence. He never put his hand up in the classroom, even when he knew the answer, and he had always felt inferior to city folk, especially if they worked in as glamorous a profession as radio or television, but he made the call anyway and was put through to Kjell Brander in jazz programming. In a voice which almost failed him, he asked which tune had been playing at just after 5:30 p.m. the day before. To be on the safe side, he hummed a bit of the tune. Kjell Brander recognized it immediately.
"Cool! You like it? You've got good taste, young man. That was Django Reinhardt's Nuage."
No one had ever called Daniel young man before. He asked how to spell the name of the song and added, even more nervously, "Who is he?"
"One of the best guitarists in the world, I'd say."
And yet he played his solos with just two fingers. Daniel could not subsequently remember what Kjell Brander had told him and what he later found out for himself, but gradually he learned that there was a story behind the man, and this made what he had heard only more precious. Django grew up in poverty in Liberchy in Belgium, sometimes stealing chickens just to survive. He began to play the guitar and violin at an early age and was considered very promising. But when he was 18, he knocked over a candle in his caravan, setting alight the paper flowers his wife sold to earn a living, and the blaze spread. Django suffered serious burns, and for a long time it was thought that he would never play again, especially not when it turned out that he had lost the use of two fingers of his left hand. Yet with the help of a new technique, he was able to keep on developing his playing, and he soon became world-famous and a cult figure. But first and foremost, Django was a gypsy, or Roma, as people now said. Daniel was also Roma. He had learned this the hard way, through the pain of being excluded and being called a gypo and worse. It had never crossed his mind that this was anything other than deeply shameful. Now Django allowed him to look upon his origins with a new pride. If Django could become the world's best, with a severely damaged hand, Daniel, too, could become something special. He borrowed some money from a girl in his class, bought a compilation record of Reinhardt's tunes, and taught himself all the classics, Minor Swing, Daphne, Belleville, Djangology, and many more, and in no time at all he changed the way he played the guitar. He abandoned his blues scales and instead played minor sixth arpeggios and solos with diminished major and minor seventh scales, and with each day his passion grew. He practiced until he had leathery calluses on his fingertips. His fervor never dimmed, not even when he slept. He played in his dreams. He thought of nothing else, and whenever he had the chance he would make for the forest, sit on a rock or tree stump and improvise for hours on end. Hungrily he absorbed new skills and new influences, not just from Django, but also from John Scofield, Pat Metheny, and Mike Stern, all the modern jazz guitar greats. At the same time his relationship with Sten deteriorated.
"You think you're special, don't you? You're just a little shit," his foster father would often snarl,
adding that Daniel always walked around with his nose in the air. Daniel could not understand it, he who had always felt inferior and inadequate. He tried his best to oblige, even though he neither wanted to nor could stop his playing.
Before long, Sten began to beat him around the ears and punch him, and sometimes his foster brothers joined in. They hit him in the stomach and on his arms, and punished him with loud noises, metal scraping against metal, or saucepan lids clashed together. Daniel now hated the work in the fields, especially in summer, when there was no escape from the muck spreading, ploughing, harrowing, and sowing. During the summer months, the boys would work from morning until late at night. Daniel tried hard to be liked and accepted again, and sometimes he succeeded. In the evenings he was happy to play requests for his brothers, and occasionally he won applause and a certain appreciation, yet he knew that he was a burden and made himself scarce whenever he could. One afternoon, as the sun beat down on the back of his neck, he heard a blackbird singing far away. He was 16 and already dreaming of his 18th birthday, when he would come of age and could leave this place far behind. He was planning to apply to the Royal College of Music in Stockholm, or get a job as a jazz musician, putting so much effort and ambition into his work that one day he would get a record contract. Dreams spun around in his head day and night. At times, as happened now, nature fed him a sound, which he developed into a riff. He whistled back at the blackbird, a variation on its song which became a melody. His fingers moved as if over an imaginary guitar, and he shuddered. Later, as an adult, he would think back to those moments when he believed something would be irretrievably lost if he did not sit down straight away to compose, and nothing in the world would stop him from sneaking off to get his guitar. Daniel could still recall the illicit thrill in his chest as he raced down to the water, Blackostjärnen, in his bare feet, overalls flapping and guitar in hand, and settled on the dilapidated jetty to pick out the melody he had been whistling and give it an accompaniment. It was a wonderful time. And that is how he would remember it. But it did not last long. One of the other boys must have seen him go and ratted on him. Sten soon appeared, bare-chested and in his shorts, and furious, and Daniel, who did not know whether to apologize or simply disappear, hesitated a second too long. Sten managed to grab hold of the guitar and yanked it away with such violence that he fell over backwards. It was not a bad fall. It just looked ridiculous. But something in Sten snapped. He got to his feet, his face puce, and smashed the guitar against the jetty. Afterwards he looked shocked, as if he did not quite understand what he had done. But it made no difference. Daniel felt as if a vital organ had been torn from his body. He yelled, "Idiot!" and "Bastard!" words he had never before uttered in front of Sten. He ran across the fields, burst into the house, stuffed his records and some clothes into a backpack, and left the farm for good. He made for the E4 motorway, and walked for hours until he picked up a lift and a tractor-trailer as far as Gävle. Then he continued south, sleeping in the forest, stealing apples and plums, and eating berries he found along the way. An old lady who drove him to Södertälje gave him a ham sandwich. A young man who took him to Jönköping bought him lunch, and late in the evening on July 22nd he arrived in Göteborg. Within a few days he had gotten himself some low-paid, cash-in-hand work down at the docks. 6 weeks later, living on virtually nothing and having occasionally slept in stairwells, he bought himself a new guitar. Not a Selmer McAferry, Django's guitar, which he dreamed of owning, but a second-hand Ibanez. He decided to make his way to New York, but it was not as easy as people said. He had neither a passport nor a visa, and you could no longer earn passage on a ship, not even as a cleaner. Early one evening, when he had finished his work in the harbour, a woman was waiting for him at the dockside. Her name was Anne-Katrine Lidholm. She was overweight and dressed in pink, and she had kind eyes. She told him she was a social worker and that someone had called her about him. That was when he found out that people were searching for him, that he had been reported as missing, and he followed her reluctantly to the social welfare agency on Järntorget. Anne-Katrine explained that she had spoken to Sten on the telephone and had a positive impression of him, which made Daniel even more suspicious.
"He misses you," she said.
"Bullshit," he said, and told her that he could not go back. He would be beaten. His life would be hell. Anne-Katrine listened to his story and afterwards gave him a few options, none of which felt right. He said he could manage on his own. She didn't need to worry. Anne-Katrine replied that he was still a minor, and that he needed support and guidance. That was when he remembered the Stockholm people, as he thought of them. psychologists and doctors who had visited him every year of his childhood. They had measured and weighed him, interviewed him and taken notes, and they had made him take tests, all kinds of tests. He never much liked them, and sometimes he had cried afterwards. He felt lonely and exposed to scrutiny, and he had thought of his mother and the life he never had with her. On the other hand, he did not hate them either. They would give him encouraging smiles and praise, and they said what a good and clever boy he was. There had never been a single unkind word. Nor did he see the visits as anything out of the ordinary. He thought it perfectly normal that the authorities should want to see how he was getting along with his foster family, and the fact that people were writing about him in medical records and protocols did not bother him. To him, it was a sign that he counted for something. Depending on who came to see him, he sometimes even viewed the visits as a welcome relief from work on the farm, especially more recently when the Stockholm people had shown an interest in his music and filmed him as he played the guitar. A few times they seemed impressed and whispered to each other, and he had gone on to dream of how those films might get around and end up in the hands of agents or record producers. The psychologists and doctors never gave more than their first names, and he knew nothing about them, apart from one woman, who shook his hand one day and introduced herself with her full name, presumably by mistake. But that was not the only reason he remembered her. He had been entranced by her figure, and her long strawberry-blonde hair, and the high heels, which were so unsuited to the dirt paths around the farmhouse. The woman had smiled at him as if she genuinely liked him. Her name was Hilda von Kantervoort, and she wore low-cut blouses and dresses, and had full red lips which he dreamed of kissing. This was the woman he thought of when he asked if he could make a call from the social welfare offices. He was given a telephone directory for the Stockholm area and nervously flicked through it. For a moment he was convinced that Hilda von Kantervoort had been a cover, and that was the first time it crossed his mind that the Stockholm people might not be regular officials of the social welfare system. But then he did find her name and dialed the number. There was no answer, so he left a message. When he returned the next day, having spent the night at Göteborg City Mission, she had returned his call and left another number. This time she answered and seemed happy to hear his voice. Straight away he realized that she knew he had run away. She told him that she was terribly sorry, and said he was exceptionally gifted. He felt unbearably lonely and stifled an impulse to cry. "Well, help me then," he said. "My dear Daniel," she said, "I would do just about anything, but we're supposed to study, not to intervene." Daniel would return to that time and again over the years. It was one of the factors that made him take on a new identity and guard it with all his might, but right then, gripping the receiver, he felt miserable and blurted, "What? What are you talking about?" Hilda became nervous, he could tell. She swiftly began to talk about other things, how he needed to finish school before he made any rash decisions. He said that all he wanted was to play the guitar. Hilda told him he could study music. He replied that he wanted to go to sea and make his way to New York to play in the jazz clubs there. She advised strongly against that.
"Not at your age, and not with everything you've got going for you," she said.
They talked for so long that Ann-Katrin and the other social workers were beginning to get impatient, and he promised to think about the options she had given him. He said he hoped to see her. She said she'd like that. But it did not come to pass. He was never to see her again. People seemed to appear from nowhere to help him get a passport, a visa, and a job as a kitchen worker and waiter on a Valenius Lines freighter. He never understood how it all happened. The freighter would take him not to New York, but to Boston. He found a slip of paper stapled to his employment contract with the following words in blue ballpoint pen. "Berklee College of Music, Boston, Massachusetts. Good luck. H." His life would never be the same again. He became an American citizen and changed his name to Dan Brody, and the years that followed were full of wonderful, exciting experiences, and yet, deep down, he felt disillusioned and alone. He nearly had a breakthrough at the start of his career. One day, jamming at Ryle's Jazz Club on Hampshire Street in Cambridge, he played a solo which was both in the spirit of Django and at the same time something else, something new, and a murmur went through the audience. People began to talk about him, and he got to know the managers and scouts of record companies, but in the end they felt he was lacking something. Courage, perhaps.
and self-confidence. Deals fell through at the last minute, and he was eclipsed by others who were less talented and yet somehow more enterprising. He would have to be satisfied with a life in the shadows. He would be the one sitting behind the star. He would always miss the fervour he had felt as he played on the jetty at Black Ostiannan. Salander had tracked down several larger hand-motion data sets, used for medical research and to develop robots, and had fed them into Hacker Republic's deep neural networks. She had been working so hard that she had forgotten to eat and drink, despite the heat. Finally, she looked up from the computer and poured herself a glass, not of water, but of Tullamore Dew. She had longed for alcohol. She had longed for sex, sunlight, junk food, the smell of the sea and the buzz of bars. She had longed for the feeling of freedom. But for now she made do with Irish whiskey. It might not be bad to end up reeking like a drunken bum, she thought. No one expects much from a wino. She looked out over Riederfjorden and closed her eyes for a few moments. She stretched her back and let the algorithms in the neural network do their job while she went into the kitchen and microwaved a pizza. Then she rang Annika Giannini. Annika was not pleased to hear what she was planning. She advised strongly against it, but when that fell on deaf ears, she told Salander that the most she could do was film the suspect, nothing more. She recommended that Salander get in touch with Hassan Ferdusi, the imam. He would help her with the more human aspects. Salander ignored this advice, but that did not matter, as Annika later contacted the imam herself and sent him off to Valholmen. Salander dug into her pizza and drank whiskey, and then hacked into Blomqvist's computer to type into the file he had called Lisbeth's stuff. Back home. Got out today. Hilda is Hilda von Canterbourg. Find her. Also, check out Daniel Brolin. He's a guitarist, very talented. And busy with other things. We'll be in touch. Blomqvist saw Salander's message and was thankful that she had been released. He tried to call her. When there was no answer, he cursed. So she, too, knew about Hilda von Canterbourg. What could that mean? Did she know her personally, or had she obtained the information by other means? He had no idea. But he needed no encouragement from Salander to go after von Canterbourg. He had already set his mind on that. On the other hand, he had not been able to discover where this Daniel Brolin came into it. He found many different Daniel Brolins online, but none was a guitar player, or any kind of musician at all. Perhaps he was not trying as hard as he might have. He had gotten too involved following up other leads. It had started the evening before, with the article Hilda's sister had told him about. When he first read it, it seemed unremarkable, too general to contain anything revelatory, let alone controversial. Hilda, under the pseudonym Leonard Bark, wrote about how the classic nature versus nurture debate had become politicized long ago. The left would like us to believe that our prospects in life are primarily determined by social factors, while the right argues for the influence of genetics. Hilda observed that science always loses its way when guided by ideology or wishful thinking. There was a note of anxiety in her introductory passage, as if she was about to propose something shocking, but the article was balanced. It held that we are affected by genetics and social environment to the same degree, which was more or less what Blomqvist had expected. One thing did surprise him, however. The environmental factors, said to be most influential in shaping us, were not those he had predicted. The essay suggested that mothers and fathers are often convinced they have a decisive influence over their children's development, but they flatter themselves. Hilda argued that our fate is more likely determined by what she called our unique environment, the one we do not share with anyone, not even our siblings. It is the environment we seek out and create for ourselves, for example, when we find something which delights and fascinates us and drives us in a certain direction. Rather like Blomqvist's reaction as a young boy, perhaps, when he saw the film All the President's Men, and was struck by a strong urge to become a journalist. Heredity and environment interact constantly, Hilda wrote. We seek out occurrences and activities which stimulate our genes and make them flourish, and we avoid things which frighten us or make us uncomfortable. She based her conclusions on a series of studies, among others, MISTRA, the Minnesota Study of Twins Reared Apart, and investigations by the Swedish Twin Registry at the Karolinska Institute. identical twins, or so-called monozygotic twins, with their essentially indistinguishable sets of genes, are ideal subjects. Thousands of twins, both identical and fraternal, grow up apart from each other, either because one or both have been adopted, or, more rarely, as the result of some unfortunate mix-up in a maternity ward. Many of these cases are heart-rending, but they also provide scientists with crucial test cases. The studies come to more or less the same conclusion. Hereditary factors, in conjunction with our unique environment, are the primary factors in shaping